Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Cori Bush can claim plenty of firsts. She's the first Black woman and the first nurse to ever represent Missouri in the U.S. House. And she's among the most prominent activists from the Ferguson protest movement to reach elected office. For her fans, Bush is a principled and passionate advocate for groups of people who typically don't have much power in Washington, D.C. But Bush's foes have painted her as an extremist who takes unpopular positions at the expense of her constituents. In early January, Bush will leave her post as Congresswoman for Missouri's 1st Congressional District, which takes in all of the city of St. Louis and some of St. Louis County. She lost a re-election bid to St. Louis County Prosecutor Wesley Bell in one of the most expensive primary campaigns in American history. Bush's criticism of Israel fueled millions of dollars worth of ads, including from political action committees associated with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Bush joins us from Washington, D.C. to discuss her time in Congress and her future. Congresswoman, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks for having me.
You are leaving office in early January after an eventful 4 years in office. We're going to detail a lot of what happened during that time in a bit. But how are you feeling as you are set to become a private citizen again?
Oh, I feel great because, you know, before I ever entered Congress, I was doing the same work that I was able to do and to lead in Congress. So I'm just going back out, you know, into the, you know, as a private citizen, doing the same work, but with a lot more knowledge and a lot more connections.
You were in a unique position when you were sworn into office in 2021. You had never served before, but I would not classify you as a political neophyte. You were an activist in Ferguson. You had run for office 2 times. We've talked before about your father being involved in St. Louis County politics. But you came into this job with some self-awareness of what it would be like. So 4 years later, did your congressional experience surprise you? And if so, how did it surprise you?
Absolutely. So because I, before I ever entered Congress, I was already working on the issues that face the people of St. Louis every day, especially the regular everyday people, from housing insecurity, food insecurity, gun violence, reproductive justice, reproductive freedom. So just so many issues that we face, affordable education, and police accountability. So yes, I was not, you know, a political neophyte walking in the door, but my third day in office was the insurrection on the U.S. Capitol. So what I thought I was going to work on in Congress, thinking, you know, I sat with my team and I had we had several conversations about legislation that we were going to roll out and the things that we wanted to prioritize. But with the insurrection happening, that changed so much. And so I had to reevaluate, you know, how I was going to focus my time, especially initially. So that's how we ended up introducing our very, very first piece of legislation right there, barricaded in our office during the insurrection of probably about 8:00 p.m. That bill to investigate and expel any member of Congress who participated in the or had any connections to the insurrection on the Capitol. So it was what I thought I was going to work on was pretty much derailed. And so from there on, we went into fight mode, which is absolutely what I'm used to, though.
Now, the people that you wanted to expel from Congress, it didn't happen. And the people that voted to overturn the election remained in Congress, and they became your colleagues. And so, and after 2023, some of these people, who include members of the Missouri delegation, you had to work with these folks. So how difficult was it to go from wanting to expel some of these folks to being forced to work with them over the last 4 years?
I still want to expel them. They still, you know, whoever was involved in the insurrection, you know, based on the 14th Amendment, they should be expelled from Congress. They should not be able to represent and serve the people of those districts. So working with them, we worked together on the things that we could agree on, the things that we wanted, what I needed for St. Louis, and if they were, if they could help with that, or if they were a barrier to getting those things done, we dealt with that. But so for me, St. Louis always has to be my first priority and my focus. So that was the way that I was able to work with those folks. And, you know, we agreed to disagree. One thing that I am not and will never be is a fake person acting like all things are well and you are this awesome person so I can get things done. No, I'm very clear. Like, this is who, this is how you hurt the people of this country, you know, but I need this for St. Louis, so let's get this done. You know, I'm just, I can't be phony.
To me, and perhaps I'm looking at this a little bit myopically because I spent a lot of time in Ferguson after Michael Brown's death, and it was a big moment in my life as well as for you. But I think the biggest thing about your election was the first time someone from the Ferguson protest movement got elected to an office like the U.S. House of Representatives. And I'm curious, when you interacted with Republicans or even some Democrats who may have had negative perceptions of people who demonstrate against police killings, did they ever try to find common ground with you? Were they curious about your experiences in Ferguson? Or did they just sort of like dismiss you out of hand because they already had hardened views of what happened in August 2020 or August 2014?
So the door was open. Let me just say, Jason, because this is something that I didn't know, you know, as I was running for this seat, the night that I won, my phone was ringing off the hook from members of Congress. And I was wondering, like, did my phone number go out in an email, you know, a mass email? But Congress members started calling me from all over the country saying, congratulations, we're going to work together. And just, you know, and so for the next several months, I spent a lot of time talking to these people, having conversations one-on-one about my background, about the work that they had been championing in Congress or whatever they were about to run for in leadership position for leadership positions. And we found common ground there. And some of them were like, I love what you've been doing. You know, I might not have been able to be public about it, but I love your work. Let's see how we can work together. Or can you help me here? So it was totally different than what I thought entering Congress would be like. I thought that people would, you know, not want to talk to me, that, you know, it would take a while for people to warm up to me, that I would have to really talk about like who I am and help people to understand that. That's not what happened at all.
Did any Republicans call you after you won and ask you about your experiences and your life story, or was it just Democrats?
That was just Democrats.
Okay.
That was just Democrats. But once I entered Congress, I had many conversations with Republicans, and you know, it's there wasn't this like right now. It's really, really tense, and there is just a lot of division. But initially, that wasn't the case. My first couple of days, things were pretty smooth with Republicans. We had a lot of conversations. We had lunch together. Like, you know, we were trying to figure out, you know, like, just, you know, who are you? This is who I am. But once the insurrection happened, so much changed because it was like the lines were drawn.
You are a prominent member of what's known as the Squad. And I characterize the Squad as a group of House members that were aligned with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. They often take more left of center views on policy than some Democrats. And they also tended to be the source of a lot of ire from Republicans. And they often were used as a foil, even among some Democrats during campaigns. Did you see being part of this group as a badge of honor, or did you see it sometimes as a burden, depending on the situation?
You know, it could be both. Never. So as far as the burden, the critiques, the criticism and the attacks, especially from the loud people that absolutely have no idea what they're talking about, but are just really, really loud. That's the part that, you know, was the burden. It's like you're on television, you're on social media, you're spewing all of this misinformation about the squad or about our work, and you are so wrong. But as far as like it being a badge of honor, what was the badge of honor was being able to represent St. Louis in this way, to where people automatically identify me as someone who's fighting for clean water, clean air, fighting for housing for everyone, and education, equity in education for each person, fighting for Medicare for all and a Green New Deal and all of these things, fighting for abortion rights, and like being identified as someone who wants to close the gender wage gap and the racial wage gap, and that was the badge of honor that St. Louis sent someone like me to Congress. And so being a part of the squad just automatically identified me as that person. But the biggest part of that was just being a regular everyday person from the community. You know, we had a principal, you know, a bartender, we're just regular everyday people.
Now, I want to make it clear that you ended up voting for a lot of President Biden's agenda. You voted for the American Rescue Plan. You voted for the Inflation Reduction Act. You voted probably, I don't know what percentage of the time that aligns with Biden's agenda, but I would imagine it's like 80, 90% of the time. But the times where you diverged obviously got a lot of attention. And the biggest one is when you and several other members of the squad voted against the 2021 infrastructure bill, which, if I recall correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you did so because you wanted to vote first on the Build Back Better Act, which was a slew of domestic priorities for the Biden administration. I want to make sure I'm accurately characterizing your vote there, first of all.
Yeah, it was so that we could vote together on both bills, because that was what the president asked for. He asked that his bill, which was the Build Back Better Act, that bill be voted on at the same time as the infrastructure bill, because he wanted his full economic agenda for the country. And so we did everything we could to support that economic package. I mean, we pushed for raising the federal minimum wage, which we know hasn't been raised since 2009. We pushed for universal pre-K, affordable child care, was paid leave. It would have rehabilitated houses and built affordable housing. But these are homes that haven't been touched in over 30 years. It would have expanded Medicare, given school a free school meals across Missouri. It was maternal health care, permanent expanded child tax credit. There was so much in this package. And President Biden said, I wrote this bill. He told me, push, don't let them let this bill drop. And so I did that. We knew that if we didn't push at that moment to secure these investments for the people of this country, that the time would not come back for us to do it again. And the only holdups to this, us getting these investments for the people who need it the most, were Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. And I might add that Joe Manchin is no longer a Democrat. Kristen Sinema is no longer a Democrat. Neither one of them will be coming back to the U.S. Senate for the 119th Congress. So we're talking about people who were not fighting for President Biden's agenda. We were the ones who were actually fighting for it. And I will say this Jason. Ron Klain, who was the president's chief of staff at the time, he went on record to say that we were actually the ones, those that were pushing for Build Back Better, the ones that voted, we might have voted no on the infrastructure package only because we were holding the leverage, we were holding the line for Build Back Better. He said we were actually the ones fighting for the president's agenda.
But obviously, this was a vote that caused political blowback for you. And I know that, and let me put this in context. There were some trade unions that never supported you. They didn't support you in 2020, they didn't support you in 2022, and they didn't support you in 2024. So we need to put that context out there. There were other labor unions that supported you 100% of the way. But like, they probably saw that vote as a betrayal of their interests, given that the members of those trade unions probably would have benefited from the infrastructure bill. Like, what would you say to some voters in the first district who belonged to some of those unions who really wanted that bill passed that were still upset with your vote 3-4 years later?
Yeah, so let me just say that it is a shame that those heads of those unions put out the lies to the people of St. Louis as well as their own members. And I'm saying that they were lies because I had a conversation right before that vote. Literally outside of the floor, I was tucked, you know, in a little room on a call with heads of unions across the state. And I told them about the vote. I told them about why I was going to vote no, told them about the conversations I had with SEIU Healthcare and that they had asked me, Corey, hold the line for us. We had those conversations. I explained everything to them, and we were all on the same page with my no vote. We were all 100% on the same page. If any one of them had said, Corey, if you do this, we will be against you, or we will consider you, an enemy to labor if you do this, then we would have had to have more conversation, and maybe I would have thought twice. But not one person, not one head of any of the unions across this state spoke up and said that. And as a matter of fact, CBTU has come out very publicly. Lou Moy has come out very publicly and spoke about that meeting and said that it is egregious what has been put out about me is regarding that vote. So I walked into the vote with the full support of labor. It was when, after I made the vote, and I believe that they started to get phone calls, you know, from higher ups probably, and then that's when they turned their backs on me.
We need to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Congresswoman Cori Bush. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. We now return to our conversation with Congresswoman Cori Bush, who will leave office in early January after serving as the first congressional district representative for the past 4 years. So let's talk about the last 14 months for you, which for better or for worse, was dominated by your call for a ceasefire in Gaza. You've been one of the most vocal critics of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians even before Hamas's October 7th attacks. And that prompted pro-Israel groups like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, to spend lots of money against your re-election bid, which we're going to talk about more in a minute. Some members of the squad, and I'll throw out Summer Lee of Pennsylvania, Ilhan Omar of Minneapolis, they also, I think, faced blowback for their criticism of Israel, but they managed to get re-elected. Why do you think you weren't able to prevail like some other, you know, vocal Israel critics in Congress?
Well, first of all, the difference is that AIPAC chose to spend money against me. AIPAC did not spend money against those other members of Congress. They focused on two, that being myself and Jamal Bowman. The one of the reasons why they made the decision, because there were conversations, you know, that we're not going to go after everyone. There were negotiations made. Who are we going to go after? And the decision was, you know, definitely target Cori Bush. And the reason why I was the other person with Jamal Bowman was because this goes back to the eviction moratorium, where in end of July, early August 2021, where I decided to camp out on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, and it took 4 nights and 5 days for us to move the president to extend the eviction moratorium to make sure that 11 million people across this country were safe from evictions during the deadly global pandemic. So big real estate was very upset that the president extended that eviction moratorium. They fought him for days, asking him not to do so. And so once he did it, they put a target on my back, and they just decided that they would do whatever they could to try to get me out of office. So they were working alongside with AIPAC and some other groups, the crypto industry, to unseat me. So it wasn't this was an effort because there were other groups that wanted me gone, with the Republicans. My primary was funded mostly by Republicans. And so you have to ask yourself, why did the Republicans spend so much money to oust a Democrat in a heavily Democratic district? It is because they wanted one of the people who was the most vocal and most outspoken against Donald Trump and his agenda, who called him out and called out his administration so freely and so often and so unapologetically. The person who is pushing for the Equal Rights Amendment. I am the very first Black woman in the history of the Equal Rights Amendment, 101 years now, to ever sponsor the legislation. As well as I am the co-founder and the co-chair of the Equal Rights Amendment Caucus. There had never been a caucus for this work before. So enshrining gender equality in the Constitution, they don't want that. They don't want to see abortion rights in the Constitution. They don't want to see LGBTQ rights. They don't want this policy, this investment in this way. And so because I'm the most vocal, they wanted to get me out.
Yeah, and maybe I'm looking at this very cynically, but like, why would it be a surprise a group like AIPAC would target somebody who is critical of the current Israeli government? You mentioned crypto. If I were in Congress right now and I said how I feel about crypto, which I feel it's a glorified pyramid scheme that kind of, targets people who don't have financial literacy, crypto would probably spend $30 million against me because they wouldn't want me. So it doesn't really seem like what AIPAC did is that different than what other interest groups that participate in the political process do. So why would you say that was like a special situation, basically?
It's because of the investment that they made, because there have been groups who target, incumbents for various reasons on different issues. The fact that they spent so much, it's not a surprise to me that they would target me. It's the unprecedented amount that they put forward. The amount of money that was spent against me made my race the second most expensive House race in U.S. history. Not in the last decade, not in several years, in U.S. history. So the fact that they spent 15 times as much, like, people have to understand this. I spent around $1.4 million when I unseated my predecessor. $1.4 million. And I won by somewhere less than 5,000 votes, somewhere around 4,000 something votes. They spent all of these groups together, all of the spending against me and for my successor was $15 million for him to win by 6,800 votes. So they had to spend an enormous amount of money to be able to get me to unseat me. And this is the thing, though, that really bothers me about this. If someone wants to run, I have no problem with that, Jason. If someone wants to run, they think that they'll do a better job. They have better ideas. That's fine. That's what we're supposed to be able to do. But when AIPAC ran this person against me. And they never once, now he came out and said that the reason why he was running against me was because I called for a ceasefire. That was initially what he said, but never once did any of their ads say anything about Israel, Gaza, ceasefire. None of them. They all said, well, Cori Bush is against Joe Biden. Cori Bush wants, you know, children in the district to drink dirty water from contaminated pipes and, you know, really ridiculous things. They lied about my record. They spew disinformation and misinformation about my work. And I just, my thing is this, tell the truth. Run on the truth. If you can run and win on the truth, then you did your job. But if you run and you win on lies, fabrications, misinformation, and disinformation, then you cheated the people of St. Louis. And that is actually what happened. Not only that, they used racism, like to change my face on mailers, you know, to make me look subhuman. That's actual racism. And the fact that that was not called out, that, you know, speaks a lot to who AIPAC is.
You might have just answered this question, but I'm just going to ask it anyways, because I followed your race in 2020 very closely. And I do remember after 2020, there were a lot of people within the Clay camp who were upset that you won. I think that former Congressman Bill Clay might have issued an email or a statement saying something kind of tart against the fact that you won. But Lacey Clay himself conceded. He congratulated you. He didn't take the tack that you did in your concession speech. Do you have any regrets that you didn't, like, follow Lacey Clay's path here, congratulate Wesley Bell, and then in 2 years politically oppose him as much as you want?
Absolutely not. The difference is this. I didn't lie about Lacey Clay's record. I ran on who I am. I ran on what I've done for the community. I ran on what I want to see. I didn't lie to the people of St. Louis about him. And so I ran on the truth and I ran on me. I didn't go around slandering his name, slandering his family. I didn't do that. And so him being able to come and say, you know, now we didn't have a conversation. That took months before he and I actually had a conversation. I reached out to him. I reached out to Lacey Clay and we were able to have a conversation. But so that is the difference here. But for someone who told me, someone who I thought was a friend, who told me that they weren't actually running against me, who I called and said, hey, I'm seeing all of this saying you're running against me when you said you're running against Josh Hawley, who you called the biggest threat to America. But I'm hearing that you're actually running against me. And he said, no. He said, no, I would never do that. I wouldn't run against you because you won your race the same way I won my race, when all along he actually was running against me. All of that deception, you know, it's not necessary. You could just come out and just tell me. You can, like, be who you are. And so because that did not happen, no, I meant what I said. I said, take care of St. Louis. I said, you know, that the people deserve better. And I mean that. And so even right now, I still have not had a conversation. I reached out to Lacey Clay. I set up meetings with Lacey Clay in DC, meetings with his office. My staff had meetings with his staff to make sure that there was as much of a transition as possible. We did that work entering. That has not happened the other way, though. There has not been any outreach.
None. You have not talked to Wesley Bell. You have not talked to anybody from his incoming staff. There's not been any conversation about a transition between you and him at all?
There has not been a conversation between he and I. Conversations between his staff. I don't know who they are.
Do you have any specific messages or hopes or desires for Congressman Bell as he prepares to represent the 1st Congressional District?
I want him to take care of St. Louis. I want him to put St. Louis first. I want the people of St. Louis to thrive by the work that he's able to do. You know, I want him to bring investments to St. Louis. We brought over $2 billion to this district. I want him to be able to do that and more. I want the success for Missouri's 1st District. And so my message is to take care of all of the people, not some of the people, to not be led by handlers and lobbyists. Don't be led by donors, be led by the people, and start that with those who have the greatest need. Take care of St. Louis.
I have a couple more questions, but I do want to go back to Gaza for a second. I know that there were a lot of voters out there who were really upset by how President Biden and Vice President Harris handled the aftermath of the October 7th attacks, or how they dealt with Israel. And they either voted third party, they didn't vote at all, they voted for Trump. Well, Trump won, and his views on Israel, I would say, are much, much different than Biden or Harris's. And I would say for people that care about the Palestinian cause, they're worse. So what's the way forward on this issue? And how do people who really care about the future of Israel and Palestine regroup to make sure there's some cessation of violence and there's some sort of solution for this age-old problem?
You know, I think that it was a mistake for the Biden-Harris team to not listen to what voters were telling them that they needed to see to earn their votes. This call went out a year, you know, like almost a year ahead. We had been working with different groups and constituencies across the country, hearing from them. And they were saying, like, this is what we need to hear. This is what we need to see from the administration so that we can support. You know, so many feel like what they thought would have been what they would have seen under a Donald Trump presidency, but this happened under, or a Republican, this happened under the Democrat. People are so disillusioned. But what I've been saying is, well, you know, we can take a break and get, you know, catch our breath, you know, let's do some healing work on ourselves. And then we have to get right back out. We have to get back out there. We have to fight this tooth and nail, because if we don't, if we just allow Donald Trump and his incoming administration to do what they want to do, whether in regards to this country, in regards to Israel and Gaza, in regards to Palestine, we we'll be leaving our legacy up to we'll just leave it up to this destruction that's coming our way.
In your farewell address, you said your time in Congress may be coming to an end for now. And then you repeated the words "for now." And that caught my attention. Does that mean a 2026 rematch against Bell is a possibility?
What it means is that I don't do anything based on ego or just a desire to, you know, be somebody or do something. Every decision that I make is based on my purpose. So whatever purpose calls for at that moment, that's what I'm going to do. So will I ever run for office again? Probably so, but I can't say absolutely. Will I ever run for Congress again? I don't know. Right now, my focus is on how we continue to do this work to mitigate the harm that's going to come from a Donald Trump presidency. So that's my focus right now, plus spending time with my family and my wonderful husband. So that is what I'm looking at. But I won't stop doing the work. And the one thing that I've said over and over again is people have to, you know, think about was I more dangerous inside of Congress or outside of it? Now that I was on the outside and I went inside and I obtained some knowledge that I didn't have before, and now I'm taking that knowledge back outside. So was it better to have me there with those strings or for me to be outside with those strings cut? So that's left to be seen.
I was just going to say, like, I understand the allure of going back and kind of getting, you know, electoral, I was going to say retribution is not the right word, but like redemption. But it also seems like it might be kind of educational for the country if you, like, I don't know, started the Cori Bush podcast and talked about all your experiences in Congress and activism. Maybe that would be more powerful than you just being one of 435 What do you think about that?
I think that there are so many possibilities, and everything, you know, pretty much is on the table right now. Nothing is off the table. So one thing that I can say is that I'm not going away. And so all of the areas, the issue areas that I've been working on for so many years, many of them for 10 years and over 10 years now, I'm going to keep doing that work. So this, I'm free to go harder. I'm free to go longer, you know, but I'm not going away. And so I will be able to push from the outside. I will be able to support my colleagues and their work that's happening on the inside by pushing from the outside. And if one day it's time for me, if that ever happens, to run again and go back, then I will absolutely do that.
And you don't have a job lined up yet. You're going to like spend some time decompressing after January 3rd. That's sort of I'm reading between the lines of your answer, but I wanted to just make sure to close that loop before I let you go.
Yeah, I have some things lined up, but I'm not ready to make any announcements right now.
Well,
but there is no, I will say this, there is no, I will not be working a regular job. I will be doing a lot of traveling and things like that. So I have some things lined up.
Well,
as I decide what's going to happen over the next couple of years, 2 to 4 years.
Well, I'm sorry I couldn't trick you into telling me what that is now, but we'll leave it at that. Congresswoman Cori Bush represents part of St. Louis County and all of the city of St. Louis in Congress up until January 3rd. She was elected in 2020, reelected in 2022. And Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Today's episode was produced by Jason Rosenbaum.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.